body grow hard. I wanted to force her away, but I would not do it, and when my legs gave under me, it was she who held me up. I was swaying, and the room was tilting, but she went on with it, and a vast silence stretched out in all directions from me, and then, without will or conviction, I thrust her backwards away. She stumbled and stood before the window, her long fingers pressed flat against her open mouth, and before I turned and collapsed into the nearby chair, I looked full at her white face for an instant, and her form swelling, it seemed, under the thin peeling of dark blue taffeta, her eyes like two crystal orbs gathering the light. I think I said, "Mother," in that instant, like some stupid mortal, and I closed my eyes. 2. I was sitting in the chair. It seemed I'd been asleep forever, but I hadn't been asleep at all. I was home in my father's house. I looked around for the fire poker and my dogs, and to see if there was any wine left. And then I saw the gold drapery around the windows and the back of Notre Dame against the evening stars. And I saw her there. We were in Paris, and we were going to live forever. She had something in her hands, another candelabra, a tinderbox. She stood very straight, and her movements were quick. She made a spark and touched it to the candles one by one, and the little flames rose, and the painted flowers on the walls rolled up to the ceiling, and the dancers on the ceiling moved for one moment and then were frozen in their circle again. She was standing in front of me, the candelabra to the right of her, and her face was white and perfectly smooth. The dark bruises under her eyes had gone away. In fact, every blemish or flaw she had ever had had gone away, though what those flaws had been I couldn't have told you. She was perfect now. And the lines given her by age had been reduced and curiously deepened, so that there were tiny laugh lines at the edge of each eye, and a very tiny crease on either side of her mouth. The barest fold of extra flesh remained to each eyelid, heightening her symmetry, the sense of triangles in her face, and her lips were the softest shade of pink. She looked delicate as a diamond can look delicate when preyed upon by the light. I closed my eyes and opened them again and saw it was no delusion, any more than her silence was a delusion, and I saw that her body was even more profoundly changed. She had the fullness of young womanhood again, the breasts that the illness had withered away. They were swelling above the dark blue taffeta of her corset, the pale pink tint of her flesh so subtle it might have been reflected light. But her hair was even more astonishing, because it appeared to be alive. So much colour moved in it that the hair itself appeared to be writhing, billions of tiny strands stirring around the flawless white face and throat. The wounds on her throat were gone. Now nothing remained but the final act of courage. Look into her eyes. Look with these vampire eyes at another being like yourself for the first time since Magnus leapt into the fire. I must have made some sound, because she responded ever so slightly as if I had. Gabrielle, that was the only name I could ever call her now. Gabrielle, I said to her, never having called her that except in some very private thoughts, and I saw her almost smile. I looked down at my wrist. The wound was gone, but the thirst gnashed in me. My veins spoke to me as if I had spoken to them, and I stared at her and saw her lips move in a tiny gesture of hunger. And she gave me a strange, meaningful expression, as if to say, "Don't you understand?" But I heard nothing from her. Silence. Only the beauty of her eyes looking full at me, and the love, perhaps, with which we saw each other. But silence stretching in all directions, ratifying nothing. I couldn't fathom it. Was she closing her mind? I asked her silently, and she didn't appear to comprehend. "Now," she said, and her voice startled me. It was softer, more resonant than before. For one moment we were in Auvergne. The snow was falling, and she was singing to me, and it was echoing as if in a great cave. But that was finished. She said, "Go, done with all of this, quickly, now." She needed to coax me, and she came closer, and she tugged at my hand. "Look at yourself in the mirror," she whispered. But I knew. I had given her more blood than I had taken from her. I was starved. I hadn't even fed before I came to her. But I was so taken with the sound of the syllables, and that glimpse of snow falling, and the memory of the singing, that for a moment I didn't respond. I looked at her fingers touching mine. I saw our flesh was the same. I rose up out of the chair, and held her two hands, and then I felt of her arms and her face. It was done, and I was alive still. She was with me now. She had come through that awful solitude, and she was with me, and I could think of nothing suddenly except holding her, crushing her to me, never letting her go. I lifted her off her feet. I swung her up in my arms, and we turned round and round. She threw back her head, and her laughter shook loose from her, growing louder and louder until I put my hand over her mouth. "You can shatter all the glass in the room with your voice," I whispered. I glanced towards the doors. Nicky and Roger were out there. "Then let me shatter it," she said, and there was nothing playful in her expression. I set her on her feet. I think we embraced again and again, almost foolishly. I couldn't keep myself from it. But other mortals were moving in the flat, the doctor and the nurses, thinking that they should come in. I saw her look to the door. She was hearing them too. But why wasn't I hearing her? She broke away from me, eyes darting from one object to another. She snatched up the candles again and brought them to the mirror, where she looked at her face. I understood what was happening to her. She needed time to see and to measure with her new vision, but we had to get out of the flat. I could hear Nicky's voice through the wall, urging the doctor to knock on the door. How was I to get her out of here? Get rid of them? "No, not that way," she said, when she saw me look at the door. She was looking at the bed, the objects on the table. She went to the bed and took her jewels from under the pillow. She examined them and put them back into the worn velvet purse. Then she fastened the purse to her skirt so that it was lost in the folds of cloth. There was an air of importance to these little gestures. I knew, even though her mind was giving me nothing, that this was all she wanted from this room. She was taking leave of things, the clothes she'd brought with her, her ancient silver brush and comb, and the tattered books that lay on the table by the bed. There was knocking at the door. "Why not this way?" she asked, and turning to the window she threw open the glass. The breeze gusted into the gold draperies and lifted her hair off the back of her neck, and when she turned I shivered at the sight of her, her hair tangling around her face, and her eyes wide and filled with myriad fragments of colour, and an almost tragic light. She was afraid of nothing. I took hold of her, and for a moment wouldn't let her go. I nestled my face into her hair, and all I could think again was that we were together, and nothing was ever going to separate us now. I didn't understand her silence, why I couldn't hear her. But I knew it wasn't her doing. And perhaps I believed it would pass. She was with me. That was the world. Death was my commander, and I gave him 1,000 victims, but I snatched her right out of his hand. I said it aloud. I said other desperate and nonsensical things. We were the same terrible and deadly beings, the two of us. We were wandering in the savage garden, and I tried to make it real for her with images, the meaning of the savage garden. But it didn't matter if she didn't understand. "The savage garden," she repeated the words reverently, her lips making a soft smile. It was pounding in my head. I felt her kissing me and making some little whisper as if in accompaniment to her thoughts. She said, "But help me, now. I want to see you do it, now. And we have forever to hold to each other. Come." Thirst. I should have been burning. I positively required the blood, and she wanted the taste. I knew she did, because I remember that I had wanted it that very first night. It struck me then that the pain of her physical death, the fluids leaving her, might be lessened if she could first drink. The knocking came again. The door wasn't locked. I stepped up on the sill of the window and reached for her, and immediately she was in my arms. She weighed nothing, but I could feel her power, the tenacity of her grip. Yet when she saw the alley below, the top of the wall, and the quay beyond, she seemed for a moment to doubt. "Put your arms around my neck," I said, "and hold tight." I climbed up the stones, carrying her with her feet dangling, her face turned upwards to me, until we had reached the slippery slates of the roof. Then I took her hand and pulled her after me, running faster and faster over the gutters and the chimney pots, leaping across the narrow alleys until we had reached the other side of the island. I'd been ready any moment for her to cry out or cling to me, but she wasn't afraid. She stood silent, looking over the rooftops of the left bank, and down at the river, crowded with thousands of dark little boats full of ragged beings, and she seemed for the moment simply to feel the wind unravelling her hair. I could have fallen in a stupor looking at her, studying her, all the aspects of the transformation. But there was an immense excitement in me to take her through the entire city, to reveal all things to her, to teach her everything I'd learned. She knew nothing of physical exhaustion now any more than I did, and she wasn't stunned by any horror such as I had been when Magnus went into the fire. A carriage came speeding along the quay below, listing badly towards the river, the driver hunched over, trying to keep his balance on the high bench. I pointed to it as it drew near, and I clasped her hand. We leapt as it came beneath us, landed soundlessly on the leather top. The busy driver never looked around. I held tight to her, steadying her until we were both riding easily, ready to jump off the vehicle when we chose. It was indescribably thrilling doing this with her. We were thundering over the bridge and past the cathedral, and on through the crowds of the Pont Neuf. I heard her laughter again. I wondered what those in the high windows saw when they looked down on us, two gaily dressed figures clinging to the unsteady roof of the carriage like mischievous children, as if it were a raft. The carriage swerved. We were racing towards Saint-Germain-des-Prés, scattering the crowds before us and roaring past the intolerable stench of the cemetery of Les Innocents as towering tenements closed in. For one second I felt the shimmer of the presence, but it was gone so quickly I doubted myself. I looked back and could catch no glimmer of it, and I realized with extraordinary vividness that Gabrielle and I would talk about the presence together, that we would talk about everything together, and approach all things together. This night was as cataclysmic in its own way as the night Magnus had changed me, and this night had only begun. The neighborhood was perfect now. I took her hand again and pulled her after me, off the carriage, down into the street. She stared, dazed, at the spinning wheels, but they were immediately gone. She didn't even look disheveled so much as she looked impossible, a woman torn out of time and place, clad only in slippers and dress, no chains on her, free to soar. We entered a narrow alleyway and ran together, arms around each other, and now and then I looked down to see her eyes sweeping the walls above us, the scores of shattered windows with their little streaks of escaping light. I knew what she was seeing. I knew the sounds that pressed in on her, but still I could hear nothing from her. And this frightened me a little to think maybe she was deliberately shutting me out. But she had stopped. She was having the first spasm of her death. I could see it in her face. I reassured her, and reminded her in quick words of the vision I'd given her before. "There is brief pain, nothing compared to what you've known. It will be gone in a matter of hours, maybe less if we drink now." She nodded, more impatient with it than afraid. We came into a little square. In the gateway to an old house a young man stood, as if waiting for someone, the collar of his grey cloak up to shield his face. Was she strong enough to take him? Was she as strong as I? This was the time to find out. "If the thirst doesn't carry you into it, then it's too soon," I told her. I glanced at her, and a coldness crept over me. Her look of concentration was almost purely human, so intent was it, so fixed, and her eyes were shadowed with that same sense of tragedy I'd glimpsed before. Nothing was lost on her. But when she moved towards the man, she wasn't human at all. She had become a pure predator, as only a beast can be a predator, and yet she was a woman walking slowly towards a man. A lady, in fact, stranded here without cape or hat or companions, and approaching a gentleman as if to beg for his aid. She was all that.
It was ghastly to watch it, the way that she moved over the stones as if she did not even touch them,
and the way that everything, even the wisps of her hair blown this way and that by the breeze, seemed somehow under her command. She could have moved through the wall itself with that relentless step. I drew back into the shadows. The man quickened, turned to her with a faint grind of his boot heel on the stones, and she rose on tiptoe as if to whisper in his ear. I think for one moment she hesitated. Perhaps she was faintly horrified. If she was, then the thirst had not had time enough to grow strong, but if she did question it, it was for no more than that second. She was taking him, and he was powerless, and I was too fascinated to do anything but watch. But it came to me quite unexpectedly that I hadn't warned her about the heart. How could I have forgotten such a thing? I rushed towards her, but she had already let him go, and he had crumpled against the wall, his head to one side, his hat fallen at his feet. He was dead. She stood looking down at him, and I saw the blood working in her, heating her and deepening her color and the red of her lips. Her eyes were a flash of violet when she glanced at me, almost exactly the color the sky had been when I'd come into her bedroom. I was silent, watching her as she looked down at the victim, with a curious amazement, as if she did not completely accept what she saw. Her hair was tangled again, and I lifted it back from her. She slipped into my arms. I guided her away from the victim. She glanced back once or twice, then looked straight forward. "It's enough for this night. We should go home to the tower," I said. I wanted to show her the treasure, and just to be with her in that safe place, to hold her and comfort her if she began to go mad over it all. She was feeling the death spasms again. There she could rest by the fire.
"No, I don't want to go yet," she said. "The pain won't go on long. You promised it wouldn't. I wanted to pass and then to be here."
She looked up at me, and she smiled.
"I came to Paris to die, didn't I?" she whispered.
Everything was distracting her. The dead man back there, slumped in his grey cape, the sky shimmering on the surface of a puddle of water, a cat streaking atop a nearby wall. The blood was hot in her, moving in her. I clasped her hand and urged her to follow me.
"I have to drink," I said.
"Yes, I see it," she whispered. "You should have taken him. I should have thought—" "And you are the gentleman, even still."
"The starving gentleman," I smiled. "Let's not stumble over ourselves devising an etiquette for monsters," I laughed. I would have kissed her, but I was suddenly distracted. I squeezed her hand too tightly. Far away, from the direction of Les Innocents, I heard the presence as strongly as ever before. She stood as still as I was, and inclining her head slowly to one side, moved the hair back from her ear.
"Do you hear it?" I asked.
She looked up at me.
"Is it another one?"
She narrowed her eyes and glanced again in the direction from which the emanation had come.
"Outlaw," she said aloud.
"What?"
"Outlaw, outlaw, outlaw." I felt a wave of lightheadedness, something of a dream remembered, fragment of a dream, but I couldn't think. I'd been damaged by doing it to her. I had to drink. "It called us outlaws," she said. "Didn't you hear it?"
And she listened again, but it was gone, and neither of us heard it. And I couldn't be certain that I received that clear pulse, "outlaw," but it seemed I had.
"Never mind it, whatever it is," I said. "It never comes any closer than that."
But even as I spoke, I knew it had been more virulent this time. I wanted to get away from Les Innocents.
"It lives in graveyards," I murmured. "It may not be able to live elsewhere for very long."
But before I finished speaking, I felt it again, and it seemed to expand and to exude the strongest malevolence I'd received from it yet.
"It's laughing," she whispered.
I studied her. Without doubt she was hearing it more clearly than I. "Challenge it," I said. "Call it a coward. Tell it to come out." She gave me an amazed look.
"Is that really what you want to do?"
she questioned me under her breath. She was trembling slightly, and I steadied her. She put her arm around her waist as if one of the spasms had come again.
"Not now, then," I said. "This isn't the time. And we'll hear it again, just when we've forgotten all about it."
"It's gone," she said.
"But it hates us, this thing."
"Let's get away from it," I said contemptuously, and putting my arm around her, I hurried her along. I didn't tell her what I was thinking, what weighed on me far more than the presence and its usual tricks. If she could hear the presence as well as I could, better, in fact, then she had all my powers, including the ability to send and hear images and thoughts. Yet we could no longer hear each other.
3.
I found a victim as soon as we had crossed the river, and as soon as I spotted the man there came the deepening awareness that everything I had done alone I would now do with her. She would watch this act, learn from it. I think the intimacy of it made the blood rush to my face. And as I lured the victim out of the tavern, as I teased him, maddened him, and then took him, I knew I was showing off for her, making it a little crueler, more playful. And when the kill came, it had an intensity to it that left me spent afterwards. She loved it. She watched everything as if she could suck up the very vision as she sucked blood. We came together again, and I took her in my arms, and I felt her heat, and she felt my heat. The blood was flooding my brain. And we just held each other, even the thin covering of our garments seeming alien, two burning statues in the dark. After that, the night lost all ordinary dimensions. In fact, it remains one of the longest nights I have ever endured in my immortal life. It was endless and fathomless and dizzying, and there were times when I wanted some defense against its pleasures and its surprises, and I had none. And though I said her name over and over to make it natural, she wasn't really Gabrielle yet to me. She was simply she, the one I had needed all of my life with all of my being. The only woman I had ever loved. Her actual death didn't take long. We sought out an empty cellar room where we remained until it was finished, and there I held on to her and talked to her as it went on. I told her everything that had happened to me again, in words this time. I told her all about the tower. I told everything that Magnus had said. I explained all the occurrences of the presence, and how I had become almost used to it and contemptuous of it, and not willing to chase it down. Over and over again I tried to send her images, but it was useless. I didn't say anything about it, neither did she, but she listened very attentively. I talked to her about Nicky's suspicions, which of course he had not mentioned to her at all, and I explained that I feared for him even more now. Another open window, another empty room, and this time witnesses to verify the strangeness of it all. But never mind. I should tell Roger some story that would make it plausible. I should find some means to do right by Nicky, to break the chain of suspicions that was binding him to me. She seemed dimly fascinated by all of this, but it didn't really matter to her. What mattered to her was what lay before her now. And when her death was finished, she was unstoppable. There was no wall that she could not climb, no door she wouldn't enter. No rooftop terrain, too steep. It was as if she did not believe she would live forever. Rather, she thought she had been granted this one night of supernatural vitality, and all things must be known and accomplished before death would come for her at dawn. Many times I tried to persuade her to go home to the tower. As the hours passed, a spiritual exhaustion came over me. I needed to be quiet there. To think on what had happened. I'd open my eyes and see only blackness for an instant. But she wanted only experiment, adventure.
She proposed that we enter the private dwellings of mortals now to search for the clothes she needed. She laughed when I said that I always purchased my clothes in the proper way. "We can hear if a house is empty," she said, moving swiftly through the streets, her eyes on the windows of the darkened mansions. "We can hear if the servants are asleep." It made perfect sense, though I'd never attempted such a thing, and I was soon following her up narrow back stairs and down carpeted corridors, amazed at the ease of it all and fascinated by the details of the informal chambers in which mortals lived. I found I liked to touch personal things, fans, snuff boxes, the newspaper the master of the house had been reading, his boots on the hearth. It was as much fun as peering into windows. But she had her purpose. In a lady's dressing room in a large Saint-Germain house, she found a fortune in lavish clothes to fit her new and fuller form. I helped to peel off the old taffeta and to dress her up in pink velvet, gathering her hair in tidy curls under an ostrich plume hat. I was shocked again by the sight of her, and the strange, eerie feeling of wandering with her through this over-furnished house full of mortal scents. She gathered objects from the dressing table, a vial of perfume, a small gold pair of scissors. She looked at herself in the glass. I went to kiss her again, and she didn't stop me. We were lovers, kissing. And that was the picture we made together, white-faced lovers, as we rushed down the servants' stairs and out into the late evening streets. We wandered in and out of the opera and the comédie before they closed, then through the ball in the Palais Royal. It delighted her the way mortals saw us, but did not see us, how they were drawn to us and completely deceived. We heard the presence very sharply after that, as we explored the churches. Then again it was gone. We climbed belfries to survey our kingdom, and afterwards huddled in crowded coffee houses for a little while, merely to feel and smell the mortals around us, to exchange secret glances, to laugh softly, tête-à-tête. She fell into dream states, looking at the steam rising from the mug of coffee, at the layers of cigarette smoke hovering around the lamps. She loved the dark, empty streets and the fresh air more than anything else. She wanted to climb up into the limbs of the trees and onto the rooftops again. She marveled that I didn't always travel through the city by means of the rooftops, or ride about atop carriages as we had done. Sometime after midnight, we were in the deserted market, just walking hand in hand. We had just heard the presence again, but neither of us could discern a disposition in it as we had before. It was puzzling me. But everything around us was astonishing her still, the refuse, the cats that chased the vermin, the bizarre stillness, the way that the darkest corners of the metropolis held no danger for us. She remarked on that. Perhaps it was that which enchanted her most of all, that we could slip past the dens of thieves unheard, that we could easily defeat anyone who should be fool enough to trouble us, that we were both visible and invisible, palpable and utterly unaccountable. I didn't rush her or question her. I was merely borne along with her and content, and sometimes lost in my own thoughts about this unfamiliar content. And when a handsome, slightly built young man came riding through the darkened stalls, I watched him as if he were an apparition, something coming from the land of the living into the land of the dead. He reminded me of Nicholas, because of his dark hair and dark eyes, and something innocent yet brooding in his face. He shouldn't have been in the market alone. He was younger than Nicky, and very foolish indeed. But just how foolish he was I didn't realize until she moved forward like a great pink feline and brought him down almost silently from the horse. I was shaken. The innocence of her victims didn't trouble her. She didn't fight my moral battles, but then I didn't fight them any more either, so why should I judge her? Yet the ease with which she slew the young man, gracefully breaking his neck when the little drink she took was not enough to kill him, angered me, though it had been extremely exciting to watch. She was colder than I. She was better at all of it, I thought. Magnus had said, "Show no mercy," but had he meant us to kill when we did not have to kill?
It came clear in an instant why she'd done it. She tore off the pink velvet girdle and skirts right there, and put on the boy's clothes. She'd chosen him for the fit of the clothes. And to describe it more truly, as she put on his garments, she became the boy. She put on his cream silk stockings and scarlet breeches, the lace shirt and the yellow waistcoat, and then the scarlet frock coat, and even took the scarlet ribbon from the boy's hair. Something in me rebelled against the charm of it, her standing so boldly in these new garments, with all her hair still full over her shoulders, looking more the lion's mane now than the lovely mass of woman's tresses it had been moments before. Then I wanted to ravage her. I closed my eyes. When I looked at her again, my head was swimming with all that we'd seen and done together. I couldn't endure being so near to the dead boy. She tied all of her blonde hair together with a scarlet ribbon and let the long locks hang down her back. She laid the pink dress over the body of the boy to cover him, and she buckled on his sword and drew it once and sheathed it again and took his cream-coloured roquelaure. "Let's go then, darling," she said, and she kissed me. I couldn't move. I wanted to go back to the tower and just be close to her. She looked at me and pressed my hand to spur me on, and she was almost immediately running ahead. She had to feel the freedom of her limbs, and I found myself pounding after her, having to exert myself to catch up. That had never happened with me and any mortal, of course. She seemed to be flying, and the sight of her flashing through the boarded-up stalls and the heaps of garbage made me almost lose my balance. Again I stopped. She came back to me and kissed me. "But there's no real reason for me to dress that way any more, is there?" she asked. She might have been talking to a child. "No, of course there isn't," I said. Maybe it was a blessing that she couldn't read my thoughts. I couldn't stop looking at her legs, so perfect in the cream-coloured stockings, and the way that the frock coat gathered at her small waist. Her face was like a flame. Remember, in those times you never saw a woman's legs like that, or the silk of breeches tight over her small belly or thighs. But she was not really a woman now, was she? Any more than I was a man. For one silent second the horror of it all bled through. "Come, I want to take to the roofs again," she said. "I want to go to the Boulevard du Temple. I should like to see the theatre, the one that you purchased and then shut up. Will you show that to me?" She was studying me as she asked this. "Of course," I said. "Why not?" We had 2 hours left of the endless night when we finally returned to the Île Saint-Louis and stood on the moonlit quays. Far down the paved street I saw my mare tethered where I'd left her. Perhaps she had gone unnoticed in the confusion that must have followed our departure. We listened carefully for any sign of Nicky or Roger, but the house appeared deserted and dark. "They are near, however," she whispered. "I think somewhere further down."
"Nicky's flat," I said. "And from Nicky's flat someone could be watching the mare. A servant posted to watch in case we came back."
"Better to leave the horse and steal another," she said.
"No, it's mine," I said. But I felt her grip on my hand tighten. Our old friend again, the presence. And this time it was moving along the Seine on the other side of the island and toward the left bank.
"Gone," she said. "Let's go. We can steal another mount.
Wait, I'm going to try to get her to come with me, to break the tether."
"Can you do that?"
"We'll see." I concentrated all my will on the mare, telling her silently to back up, to pull loose from the bond holding her, and come. In a second, the horse was prancing, jerking at the leather. Then she reared, and the tether broke. She came clattering towards us over the stones, and we were on her immediately, Gabrielle leaping up first and I right behind her, gathering up what was left of the rein as I urged the horse to go into a dead run. As we crossed the bridge, I felt something behind us, a commotion, the tumult of mortal minds. But we were lost in the black echo chamber of the Île de la Cité. When we reached the tower, I lighted the resin torch and took her down with me into the dungeon. There was no time now to show her the upper chamber. Her eyes were glassy, and she looked about herself sluggishly as we descended the screw stairs. Her scarlet clothes gleamed against the dark stones. Ever so slightly she recoiled from the dampness. The stench from the lower prison cells disturbed her, but I told her gently it was nothing to do with us. And once we had entered the huge burial crypt, the smell was shut out by the heavy, iron-studded door. The torchlight spread out to reveal the low arches of the ceiling, the three great sarcophagi with their deeply graven images. She did not seem afraid. I told her that she must see if she could lift the stone lid of the one she chose for herself. I might have to do it for her. She studied the three carved figures. And after a moment's reflection, she chose not the woman's sarcophagus, but the one with a knight in armor carved on the top of it. And slowly she pushed the stone lid out of place so she could look into the space within. Not as much strength as I possessed, but strong enough. "Don't be frightened," I said.
"No, you mustn't ever worry on that account," she answered softly.
Her voice had a lovely, frayed sound to it, the faint timbre of sadness. She appeared to be dreaming as she ran her hands over the stone.
"By this hour," she said, "she might have already been laid out, your mother, and the room would be full of evil smells and the smoke of hundreds of candles. Think how humiliating it is, death. Strangers would have taken off her clothes, bathed her, dressed her. Strangers seen her emaciated and defenseless in the final sleep. And those whispering in the corridors would have talked of their good health, and how they have never had the slightest illness in their families. No, no consumption in their families. The poor Marquise, they would have said. They would have been wondering, did she have any money of her own? Did she leave it to her sons? And the old woman, when she came to collect the soiled sheets, she would have stolen one of the rings off the dead woman's hand." I nodded.
"And so we stand in this dungeon crypt," I wanted to say, "and we prepare to lie down on stone beds, with only rats to keep us company. But it's infinitely better than that, isn't it? It has its dark splendor, to walk the nightmare terrain forever." She looked wan, cold all over. Sleepily she drew something out of her pocket. It was the golden scissors she'd taken from the lady's table in the Faubourg Saint-Germain, sparkling in the light of the torch like a bauble.
"No, mother," I said.
My own voice startled me. It leapt out, echoing too sharply under the arched ceiling. The figures on the other sarcophagi seemed merciless witnesses. The hurt in my heart stunned me. "Evil sound. The snipping, the shearing. Her hair fell down in great, long locks on the floor.
Oh, mother."
She looked down at it, scattering it silently with the tip of her boot, and then she looked up at me. And she was a young man now, certainly, the short hair curling against her cheek, but her eyes were closing. She reached out to me, and the scissors fell out of her hands.
"Rest now," she whispered.
"It's only the rising sun," I said to reassure her. She was weakening sooner than I did. She turned away from me and moved towards the coffin. I lifted her, and her eyes shut. Pushing the lid of the sarcophagus even farther to the right, I laid her down inside, letting her pliant limbs arrange themselves naturally and gracefully. Her face had already smoothed itself into sleep, her hair framing her face with a young boy's locks. Dead, she seemed, and gone. The magic undone. I kept looking at her. I let my teeth cut into the tip of my tongue, until I felt the pain and tasted the hot blood there. Then, bending low, I let the blood fall in tiny, shining droplets on her lips. Her eyes opened. Violet, blue, and glittering, they stared up at me. The blood flowed into her opening mouth, and slowly she lifted her head to meet my kiss. My tongue passed into her. Her lips were cold. My lips were cold. But the blood was hot, and it flowed between us.
"Good night, my darling one," I said.
my dark angel, Gabrielle.
She sank back into stillness as I let her go. I closed the stone over her.
4. I did not like rising in the black underground crypt. I didn't like the chill in the air, and that faint stench from the prison below, the feeling that this was where all the dead things lay. A fear came over me. What if she didn't rise? What if her eyes never opened again? What did I know of what I'd done? Yet it seemed an arrogant thing, an obscene thing to move the lid of the coffin again and gaze at her in her sleep as I had done last night. A mortal shame came over me. At home I would never have dared to open her door without knocking, never dared to draw back the curtains of her bed. She would rise. She had to. And better that she should lift the stone for herself, know how to rise, and that thirst should drive her to it at the proper moment as it had driven me. I lighted the torch on the wall for her, and went out for a moment to breathe the fresh air. Then, leaving gates and doors unlocked behind me, I went up into Magnus's cell to watch the twilight melt from the sky. I'd hear her, I thought, when she awakened. An hour must have passed. The azure light faded, the stars rose, and the distant city of Paris lighted its myriad tiny beacons. I left the windowsill where I had sat against the iron bars, and I went to the chest, and began to select jewels for her. Jewels she still loved. She had taken her old keepsakes with her when we left her room. I lighted the candles to help me see, though I didn't really need them. The illumination was beautiful to me. Beautiful on the jewels. And I found very delicate and lovely things for her. Pearl-studded pins that she might wear in the lapels of her mannish little coat, and rings that would look masculine on her small hands if that was what she wanted. I listened now and then for her, and this chill would clutch my heart. What if she did not rise? What if there had been only that one night for her? Horror thudding in me, and the sea of jewels in the chest, the candlelight dancing in the faceted stones, the gold settings, it meant nothing. But I didn't hear her. I heard the wind outside, the great soft rustle of the trees, the faint distant whistling of the stable boy as he moved about the barn, the neighing of my horses. Far off, a village church bell rang. Then very suddenly there came over me the feeling that someone was watching me. This was so unfamiliar to me that I panicked. I turned, almost stumbling into the chest, and stared at the mouth of the secret tunnel. No one was there. No one in this small, empty sanctum with the candlelight playing on the stones and Magnus's grim countenance on the sarcophagus. And then I looked straight in front of me at the barred window. And I saw her looking back at me. Floating in the air, she seemed to be, holding to the bars with both hands, and she was smiling. I almost cried out. I backed up, and the sweat broke out all over my body. I was embarrassed suddenly to be caught off guard, to be so obviously startled. But she remained motionless, smiling still, her expression gradually changing from serenity to mischievousness. The candlelight made her eyes too brilliant. "It's not very nice to frighten other immortals like that," I said. She laughed more freely and easily than she ever had when she was alive. Relief coursed through me as she moved, made sounds. I knew I was blushing. "How did you get there?" I said. I went to the window and reached through the bars and clasped both her wrists. Her little mouth was all sweetness and laughter. Her hair was a great shimmering mane around her face. "I climbed the wall, of course," she said. "How do you think I got here?"
"Well, go down. You can't come through the bars. I'll go to meet you."
"You're very right about that," she said. "I've been to all the windows. Meet me on the battlements above. It's faster." She started climbing, hooking her boots easily into the bars. Then she vanished. She was all exuberance, as she'd been the night before as we came down the stairs together. "Why are we lingering here?" she said. "Why don't we go on now to Paris?" Something was wrong with her, lovely as she was. Something not right. What was it? She didn't want kisses now, or even talk, really. And that had a little sting to it. "I want to show you the inner room," I said, "and the jewels."
"The jewels?" she asked.
She hadn't seen them from the window. The cover of the chest had blocked her view. She walked ahead of me into the room where Magnus had burned, and then she lay down to crawl through the tunnel. As soon as she saw the chest, she was shocked by it. She tossed her hair a little impatiently over her shoulder and bent to study the brooches, the rings, the small ornaments so like those heirlooms she had to sell long ago one by one.
"Why, he must have been collecting them for centuries," she said, "and such exquisite things. He chose what he would take, didn't he? What a creature he must have been."
Again, almost angrily, she pushed her hair out of her way. It seemed paler, more luminous, fuller, a glorious thing. "The pearls, look at them," I said, "and these rings." I showed her the ones I'd already chosen for her. I took her hand and slipped the rings on her fingers. Her fingers moved as if they had life of their own, could feel delight, and again she laughed.
"Ah, but we are splendid devils, aren't we?"
"Hunters of the savage garden," I said.
"Then let's go into Paris," she said.
Faint touch of pain in her face. The thirst. She ran her tongue over her lips. Was I half as fascinating to her as she was to me? She raked her hair back from her forehead, and her eyes darkened with the intensity of her words.
"I wanted to feed quickly tonight," she said. "Then go out of the city, into the woods. Go where there are no men and women about. Go where there is only the wind and the dark trees and the stars overhead. Blessed silence."
She went to the window again. Her back was narrow and straight, and her hands at her sides, alive with the jeweled rings. And coming as they did out of the thick cuffs of the man's coat, her hands looked all the more slender and exquisite. She must have been looking at the high, dim clouds, the stars that burned through the purple layer of evening mist. "I have to go to Roger," I said under my breath. "I have to take care of Nicky. Tell them some lie about what's happened to you." She turned, and her face looked small and cold suddenly, the way it could at home when she was disapproving. But she'd never really look that way again.
"Why tell them anything about me?" she said. "Why ever even bother with them again?"
I was shocked by this, but it wasn't a complete surprise to me. Perhaps I'd been waiting for it. Perhaps I'd sensed it in her all along, the unspoken questions. "I wanted to say Nicky sat by your bed when you were dying. Does that mean nothing?" But how sentimental, how mortal that sounded, how positively foolish. Yet it wasn't foolish.
"I don't mean to judge you," she said. She folded her arms and leaned against the window. "I simply don't understand. Why did you write to us? Why did you send us all the gifts? Why didn't you take this white fire from the moon and go where you wanted with it?"
"But where should I want to go?" I said. "Away from all those I'd known and loved? I did not want to stop thinking of you, of Nicky, even of my father and my brothers. I did what I wanted," I said.
"Then conscience played no role in it?"
"If you follow your conscience, you do what you want," I said. "But it was simpler than that. I wanted you to have the wealth I gave you. I wanted you to be happy." She reflected for a long time. "Would you have had me forget you?" I demanded. It sounded spiteful, angry. She didn't answer immediately.
"No, of course not," she said. "And had it been the other way around, I would never have forgotten you either. I'm sure of it. But the rest of them? I don't give a damn about them. I shall never exchange words with them again. I shall never lay eyes on them."
I nodded, but I hated what she was saying. She frightened me.
"I cannot overcome this notion that I've died," she said, "that I am utterly cut off from all living creatures. I can taste, I can see, I can feel, I can drink blood. But I am like something that cannot be seen, cannot affect things."
"It's not so," I said. "And how long do you think it will sustain you, feeling and seeing and touching and tasting, if there is no love, no one with you?" The same uncomprehending expression. "Oh, why do I bother to tell you this?" I said. I am with you. We're together. You don't know what it was like when I was alone. You can't imagine it.
I trouble you, and I don't mean to, she said. Tell them what you will. Maybe you can somehow make up a palatable story. I don't know. If you want me to go with you, I'll go. I'll do what you ask of me. But I have one more question for you.
She dropped her voice. Surely you don't mean to share this power with them? No, never. I shook my head as if to say the thought was incredible. I was looking at the jewels, thinking of all the gifts I'd sent, thinking of the dollhouse. I had sent them a dollhouse. I thought of Renault's players, safely across the channel.
Not even with Nicholas?
No, God, no! I looked at her. She nodded slightly, as if she approved of this answer, and she pushed at her hair again in a distracted way.
Why not with Nicholas? She asked.
I wanted this to stop. Because he's young, I said, and he has life before him. He is not on the brink of death. Now I was more than uneasy. I was miserable. In time he'll forget about us. I wanted to say, about our conversation.
He could die tomorrow, she said. A carriage could crush him in the streets.
Do you want me to do it? I glared at her.
No, I don't want you to do it. But who am I to tell you what to do? I am trying to understand you.
Her long, heavy hair had slipped over her shoulders again, and exasperated, she took hold of it in both hands. Then suddenly she made a low, hissing sound, and her body went rigid. She was holding her long tresses and staring at them.
My God, she whispered.
And then, in a spasm, she let go of her hair and screamed. The sound paralyzed me. It sent a flash of white pain through my head.
I had never heard her scream. And she screamed again as if she were on fire.
She had fallen back against the window, and she was screaming louder as she looked at her hair. She went to touch it and then pulled her fingers back from it as if it were blazing. And she struggled against the window, screaming and twisting from side to side, as if she were trying to get away from her own hair.
Stop it, I shouted. I grabbed hold of her shoulders and shook her. She was gasping. I realized instantly what it was. Her hair had grown back. It had grown back as she slept, until it was as long as it had been before. And it was thicker, even, more lustrous. That is what was wrong with the way she looked, what I had noticed and not noticed, and what she herself had just seen.
Stop it! Stop it now! I shouted louder, her body shaking so violently I could hardly keep her in my arms. It's grown back! That's all! I insisted. It's natural to you, don't you see? It's nothing. She was choking, trying to calm herself, touching it and then screaming as if her fingertips were blistered. She tried to get away from me, and then ripped at her hair in pure terror. I shook her hard this time.
Gabrielle, I said, do you understand me? It's grown back, and it will every time you cut it. There's no horror in it. For the love of hell, stop!
I thought if she didn't stop, I'd start to rave myself. I was trembling as badly as she was. She stopped screaming, and she was giving little gasps. I'd never seen her like this, not in all the years and years in Auvergne. She let me guide her towards the bench by the hearth, where I made her sit down. She put her hands to her temples and tried to catch her breath, her body rocking back and forth slowly. I looked about for a scissor. I had none. The little gold scissor had fallen on the floor of the crypt below. I took out my knife. She was sobbing softly in her hands. "Do you want me to cut it off again?" I asked. She didn't answer. "Gabrielle, listen to me." I took her hands from her face. "I'll cut it again if you like. Each night. Cut it and burn it. That's all." She stared at me in such perfect stillness suddenly that I didn't know what to do. Her face was smeared with blood from her tears, and there was blood on her linen, blood all over her linen. "Shall I cut it?" I asked her again. She looked exactly as if someone had hit her and made her bleed. Her eyes were wide and wondering, the blood tears seeping out of them down her smooth cheeks, and as I watched, the flow stopped, and the tears darkened and dried to a crust on her white skin. I wiped her face carefully with my lace handkerchief. I went to the clothing I kept in the tower, the garments made for me in Paris that I brought back and kept here now. I took off her coat. She made no move to help me or stop me, and I unhooked the linen shirt that she wore. I saw her breasts, and they were perfectly white except for the palest pink tint to the small nipples. Trying not to look at them, I put the fresh shirt on her and buttoned it quickly. Then I brushed her hair, brushed it and brushed it, and, not wanting to hack at it with a knife, I braided it for her in one long plait, and I put her coat back on her. I could feel her composure and her strength coming back. She didn't seem ashamed of what had happened, and I didn't want her to be. She was merely considering things, but she didn't speak. She didn't move. I started talking to her. "When I was little, you used to tell me about all the places you'd been. You showed me pictures of Naples and Venice, remember? Those old books? And you had things, little keepsakes from London and St. Petersburg, all the places you'd seen." She didn't answer. "I want us to go to all those places. I want to see them now. I want to see them and live in them. I want to go farther, even, places I never dreamed of seeing when I was alive." Something changed in her face. "Did you know it would grow back?" she asked in a whisper. "No. I mean, yes. I mean, I didn't think. I should have known it would do that." For a long time she stared at me again in the same still, listless fashion. "Does nothing about it all ever frighten you?" she asked. Her voice was guttural and unfamiliar. "Does nothing ever stop you?" she asked. Her mouth was open and perfect and looked like a human mouth. "I don't know," I whispered helplessly. "I don't see the point," I said. But I felt confused now. Again I told her to cut it each night and to burn it. Simple. "Yes, burn it," she sighed. "Otherwise it should fill all the rooms of the tower in time, shouldn't it? It would be like Rapunzel's hair in the fairy tale. It would be like the gold that the miller's daughter had to spin from straw in the fairy tale of the mean dwarf, Rumpelstiltskin." "We write our own fairy tales, my love," I said. "The lesson in this is that nothing can destroy what you are now. Every wound will heal. You are a goddess."
"And the goddess thirsts," she said.
Hours later, as we walked arm in arm like two students through the boulevard crowds, it was already forgotten. Our faces were ruddy, our skin warm. But it did not leave her to go to my lawyer, and she did not seek the quiet, open country as she had wanted to do. We stayed close to each other, the faintest shimmer of the presence now and then making us turn our heads. 5. By the hour of 3, when we reached the livery stables, we knew we were being stalked by the presence. For half an hour, 45 minutes at a time, we wouldn't hear it. Then the dull hum would come again. It was maddening me. And though we tried hard to hear some intelligible thoughts from it, all we could discern was malice and an occasional tumult like the spectacle of dry leaves disintegrated in the roar of the blaze. She was glad that we were riding home. It wasn't that the thing annoyed her. It was only what she had said earlier. She wanted the emptiness of the country, the quiet. When the open land broke before us, we were going so fast that the wind was the only sound, and I think I heard her laughing, but I wasn't sure. She loved the feel of the wind as I did. She loved the new brilliance of the stars over the darkened hills. But I wondered if there had been moments tonight when she had wept inwardly, and I had not known. There had been times when she was obscure and silent, and her eyes quivered as if they were crying, but there were absolutely no tears. I was deep into thoughts of that, I think, when we neared a dense wood that grew along the banks of a shallow stream, and quite suddenly the mare reared and lurched to the side. I was almost thrown, it was so unexpected. Gabrielle held on tight to my right arm. Every night I rode into this little glade, crashing over the narrow wooden bridge above the water. I loved the sound of the horse's hooves on the wood and a climb up the sloping bank, and my mare knew the path. But now she would have none of it.